From the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Roderick, Sun columnist, and this is Roughly Speaking for June 3rd, 2019. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan has decided not to challenge Donald Trump in the Republican presidential primaries of 2020. Hogan told supporters on Friday that instead of running for president, he would start a national nonprofit organization called An America United. The aim would be, quote, bipartisan common sense solutions to create more and better jobs, promote fiscal responsibility, environmental protection, improve education, and rebuild America's decaying and neglected infrastructure, end quote. Based on polling over the last year and longer, Hogan had no chance of unseating Trump, but the next general election is a year and a half away or so, and who knows what will happen between now and then. A fresh CNN poll shows Trump's approval rating at 43%, with disapproval at 52%. And the poll shows a slight uptick in the number of Democrats who think Congress should push for Trump's impeachment, based on the report delivered by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Last week, right after Mueller appeared at the Department of Justice to say farewell for now, I had a conversation about the special counsel, Trump, the prospects of impeachment, and the long list of Democrats who are running to unseat him. My guests for this episode of Roughly Speaking are Malia Cromer, who runs the Goucher Poll at Goucher College in Towson, and Richard Striner, author and professor of history at Washington College in Chestertown. So on Wednesday morning, we had Robert Mueller. You know, for the first time, any of us have heard his voice during this two-year investigation of the special counsel. And he said, listen, I'm leaving, I'm resigning, we're closing the office, and the report of the special counsel, if you have questions about it, just read it, right? And he left us with that. He may come back, we may see him testify at a hearing. So I just wanted to get a sense from the two of you, Malia and Richard, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, I know it's unpredictable. We've never lived through anything so unpredictable before.
We've never lived through anything like this before. All the Watergate came close to it in some ways, but this is worse by many magnitudes.
So what do you mean? How do you see it? For those who weren't around in Richard Nixon's days,
yeah.
How is it worse by magnitudes?
For a number of reasons. Nixon was a very bad man in certain ways, but he wasn't all bad, arguably. He was somewhat intelligent, some would say quite intelligent in his better moods. He embraced a number of policy positions that displeased the hard right. I mean, you know, EPA was founded with his approval. Amtrak, OSHA, you know, lots of enlightened measures.
He wanted drug treatment on demand for Americans addicted to drugs.
He advocated universal health care insurance. Never went anywhere, but he advocated it. And a man of moods, and his darker moods led him and the country quite astray, but at least in public he could maintain a semblance of you know, poise and dignity. And even as his worst instincts led him, you know, further and further astray, it was nothing like this. It was nothing like this.
He was a Republican and represented a part of the Republican Party that was fairly moderate, I guess, on everything, I guess, except the Vietnam War.
Well,
we won't go there.
To conservative, but conservatism itself was in flux, and the Republican Party was so different. It embraced a great deal of ideological diversity, as it had for many decades. In the 1960s, there were still liberal Republicans, you know, self-labeled as that. And there were lots of them. Jacob Javits.
Mac Mathias in Maryland.
Of course.
J. Glenn Bell.
Connie Morella. I mean, I give you lots of other local examples. But so that when the issue was forced in 1973 and 4, there were enough Republicans who had a conscience. They were intelligent. They were relatively decent human beings, a lot of them. And they could also see the double-sidedness of the politics from the purely partisan instinct because, you know, this man was going down in flames and his supporters might very well go down with him. So some of them decided just on that basis to cut the losses and get rid of him.
Right.
And, you know, Gerald Ford ushered in an all-too-brief period of calm, decency, and sanity. One of our better presidents, if you look at it that way. Too bad he lost in 76. That's what I say.
I don't know what kind of polling we had in 1973. I didn't have a chance to go look that up. But I do wonder what the country's mood was or attitude was about Nixon and impeachment during that year previous to his resignation. You know, when we finally had hearings, had the Watergate hearings in 1973, a year after the Watergate break-in, and then a year later, Nixon's resignation. When you think about it, it's pretty compact, 2 years, and it was all over with. What are we seeing today? Because everything I hear or read, Malia, indicates that people aren't in the mood for impeachment.
Well, there's a couple things that are going on. I think during Nixon's time, you started to see his support among Republicans start to fall out. So the closer they got toward the impeachment trials, the fewer and fewer Republicans actually start to support him, at least in terms of public opinion. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing that at all with President Trump's approval numbers. So if you look at his approval numbers over time among Republicans, it's stable, like scary stable.
Like 86%?
86%, and it's almost unmovable by these forces normally you'd think that it would cause at least some ebb and flow. And in the same respect, Democrats are unmoved as well. So Democrats have not liked him since the moment he got elected, continue not to like him, and there really isn't any movement to go. So where we're at right now, that sort of steady state of around a 43% approval rating, it's going to maybe bump up maybe in the 45, 46 sometimes, maybe drop a little bit lower. But that's really an artifact of Democrats not liking him. Republicans supporting him because of economic situations, and the independents in the middle sort of bouncing back and forth and back and forth. And what it creates is this environment where even with impeachment sort of on the table, you don't see a lot of appetite for it in the public. And you see that division among approval rating start to boil down to divisions among whether they should be impeachment proceedings. And before this happened with the Mueller, his actual public
report. Yeah.
Post his redacted report, when he put it out, post redacted report, you see around 35% of individuals support impeachment and 47% say no impeachment proceedings.
Interesting. So we haven't had Mueller actually sitting at a table answering questions from senators probably be congressmen. And we had the Senate Watergate hearings, as I said, during the summer of 73, which really dramatized what this was all about. There was some really incredible moments during those hearings.
I think
that would change attitudes, wouldn't it, if people actually saw Mueller?
There's a cultural difference between those days and these days. In 1973, I mean, cable TV was in its infancy. You still had the big three networks. And when, the Irvin Committee hearings were broadcast live, it was very much the way it was in 1954 with the Army McCarthy hearings. It was must-see, you know, TV viewing, and it was on at the same time, you know.
I think it would be now, Richard. I think if Robert Mueller were to testify, you would see that. We saw that with the Kavanaugh hearings for the Supreme Court. We saw high ratings.
But we see a different lens, though, than we did back then, right? And so it's not just about watching the hearing.
Things are more fragmented with media, you know, and not only the infinite cable channels, but the digital funny business through which people are fiddling with their gadgets at all hours of
yes,
the day.
Yes, but what my point is that people would see it and hear it. Now, the filters are there that weren't in place in 1973, such as Fox News, for instance, or MSNBC, mm-hmm. to filter it through that lens. You get your conservative and liberal view of it. But anyway, I think people would find it to be compelling television, and it might change some minds toward this idea of obstruction of justice and
I'm
Trump.
I'm not sure, Dan, because and the reason being, several public opinion polls have asked about this idea of obstruction of justice, whether people believe that Trump obstructed justice, and it's remarkably stable over time. We've been talking about this for over a year, and around 80% of Democrats say absolutely. And then on the other hand, only a much smaller percentage of Republicans. And so the question is what maybe the spectacle perhaps of him, the impeachment trial, would move public opinion. But the content certainly hasn't moved it. What new information will we find? The Well, we find out during those hearings that we already don't know, and that information has yet to really move things.
I'm just saying there's a difference between a paper report that cites 10 instances of possible obstruction of justice and a person sitting at a table describing them answering questions from members of Congress.
Maybe.
And it may move people. Now, you mentioned the economy.
Sure.
If any other president had this kind of economy, you know, low unemployment, although I don't know what else is so great about it for average people, for working people. I mean, there has been some increase in wages here and there, but not very much. And anyway, it's said to be a booming economy if you just go by the unemployment figures, right? Any other president would be riding high, no? At what, 60%, 65%, 70% maybe approval?
There are several different factors at work, and sometimes they converge, sometimes they don't. A lot of it is emotional and perceptual. As to unemployment numbers, those numbers can be fiddled with. You know, Bureau of Labor Statistics can cook the numbers all sorts of ways. For example, people who have been trying fruitlessly to find work after, you know, X many months and then have given up.
Okay.
They don't count them.
All right. But the numbers that are used for all presidents, right? So they cooked whoever's in office.
Yes.
And
this
is pretty damn low. I mean, 3.5% or something.
But there is often a mental disconnect for a lot of people between their own real-life situation and the possibility that their situation is ramified many times over, you know, throughout the economy, and the feelings that they have about candidates, about how the country is doing. I mean, we're all somewhat irrational sometimes, but it's an emotional process that connects to the increased tribalism of our politics.
I think that's what Malia is describing by the numbers is tribalism.
Solidarity,
yeah.
It goes beyond ideology. It's tribal. It's emotional. And I'm sorry to have to say that for a great many Republicans, what's really going on, I think, is raw power worship. Domination for its own sake is horrible. But there's another side to it. There's always a dark side to the moon, huh? there are a lot of fault lines and schisms of an emotional nature, you know, in both parties, ideological as well as emotional, too. But you look, for example, at the Christian right, the evangelical right, big, big force in Republican power politics. There is a conscience movement underway, you know, even among some evangelicals who in some respects are by my standards quite shrill. However, they have a conscience and they're calling their fellow Christians to examine the discrepancy between the kind of politics they espouse and the Sermon on the Mount. Where might this go? It's impossible to say. You know, fast-breaking news might lead to a compelling event that causes an emotional catharsis that would suddenly change.
What would that be? I mean, we've been through so much with Trump as a candidate and as president. So I'm with you on this. I'm following you, but I wonder, what would that be?
I don't know.
What would it be?
I'm waiting in the hopeful expectation for something, you know, to start to dislodge
cover up money for a porn star? I mean, that doesn't seem
Nothing seems to do it with these people.
We have prominent ministers who are praying for Trump.
Yes, right? yes.
So.
Right. but as to the future, as to what might suddenly alter everything, maybe nothing will. Maybe something will.
Okay, but this gets to the question
contingent.
Of what the Democrats in Congress should be doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't have hearings, if you don't issue subpoenas, you don't do something, none of what you just described can happen. The potential isn't there.
Sure, but the argument would be for those individuals who don't want to see the impeachment proceedings happen but would like to see Trump voted out of office, is they would like to see the electoral system actually work to remove him,
right?
That we're this close to the 2020 election cycle and that the impeachment – and this is Pelosi's argument that she's been making – that the that when you force the issue, it might actually be a losing issue for Democrats. It will create for a rallying cry for Republicans. And if you go back to 2018, as much credit as the progressives got for those sort of the big the AOCs and the Priestleys and the Omars of the world, mm-hmm. It was really moderates in Republican-leaning districts that won the House of Representatives for them. And it's the fear that I think that Pelosi looks at the map, mm-hmm. and she and the fear among Democrats is that they push the impeachment issue, that it will rally Republicans and they will end up taking losses in the House of Representatives. And there's a fear among the American people, particularly among Democrats, unlike 2000, when Trump was elected in 2016, that there is a significant portion of the American populace who thinks he will win a second term. And that is a lot of from Democratic establishment leadership. That's a risk they are just not willing to take. And the impeachment, it's an unknown factor.
It's a compelling argument, actually, I find it to be, because mm-hmm. the idea of people going in to vote him out of office, I think there's a lot of energy for that in the country. Maybe more significant in the minds of voters and of Americans than letting Congress impeach him. And that he might actually become a martyr if he is impeached.
Well, Pelosi has made her point of view pretty explicit, and there is a great deal to be said for it. Her worst-case scenario is that the House moves to impeach now. The Judiciary Committee holds hearings. They get as much evidence as they can. The Democratic House does its thing, and then the Republican Senate just cynically, you know, refuses to convict. Doesn't matter what the evidence
Mitch
is.
Mitch McConnell, we're not going to have hearings. We're not going to do any of that.
That's right. Ruthless.
How'd you like
Absolutely.
My Mitch McConnell?
It was actually pretty good, Dan. I was must admit.
Absolutely ruthless. Cold. Yeah. And then you know what Donald would say. He's been vindicated.
Vindicated. Yeah.
Pelosi foresees that. She's totally right. However, there's another scenario, and I'm sure she is aware of it. It's a very, very high risk consideration, and there are points on both sides. And you can't say who's right because it depends on how things play it out. The impeachers, and I would love to see it happen, are working on the theory that if they start the impeachment proceedings, they might get access, you know, by subpoena to a lot more damning evidence than they could possibly get without impeachment proceedings. And that once the process starts, it feeds on itself and develops a rolling momentum. And then, you know, some of the Republicans in the Senate might start to become afraid. I mean, you've got Susan Collins, lady from Alaska, I forget her name.
Lisa Murkowski.
Well, you know, if the stakes get high enough and the pressure becomes excruciating enough, I wonder what Mitt Romney might, you know, start thinking. I wonder what, you know, a number of people like that. Chuck Grassley, I mean, he used to call himself a Republican liberal decades ago, I believe.
Right.
I presume he still has a shred of conscience left. You know, he's no spring chicken. You know, what's it all about?
Mm-hmm.
Patriotic duty, what's right? Things as simple and fundamental as that. Any 10-year-old child could understand it. And as though the momentum builds on itself, who's to say?
Akin with your argument, I just add this, is the idea I've heard expressed by people just, you know, water cooler. Actually, we do have a water cooler here.
That's good.
How do you let it go? You can't just let it go. And then near the water cooler, somebody said, well, they don't have to just let it go because
Pelosi's trying to get evidence, you know.
You can get what you can now,
yeah.
Right? But also, you can vote him out of office and then indict him.
Yes, that would be a lovely scenario. I'd love to see it happen. I'd love to see him locked up. But the question is what to do or not do right now.
And for me, the fundamental underlying question is whether any more information gleaned from impeachment proceedings would actually move public opinion in those key states to actually swing the. So all the senators moving one way or the other, these Republican senators perhaps flipping and deciding to impeach, that will only happen if public opinion is moved in those states, in those particular states in which an election is looming.
Mm-hmm.
And without that movement, it's really difficult to say if 90% of your Republican constituents at home support the president and don't support impeachment proceedings. It is difficult for them to – I mean, it shouldn't be difficult, right, if the evidence is presented in front of them. But it's – we're this is – there's – this is reality. This is politics, and it is what it is.
It is, and the independent factor, I presume, is a significant one in a lot of these. Independent voters, it's natural for elected Republican officials to care about what Republican voters think. But if Democratic voters plus independent voters become strong enough to throw them or any other Republican out, then the calculation becomes different.
I want to ask you, Malia, about the 43%.
Mm-hmm.
You said you could see Trump moving up to 45 or 46%.
He's bumped up almost. In some public opinion polls since 2017, he's been as high as like a 46 to 48%.
Right. As low as 37, right?
Right. His low. It's hit around like in the mid-30s, low-30s. It sort of ebb and flows in that general direction. Now, he is right now at this point in his presidency less popular than his four predecessors, than they were at this point in their presidency.
Right. So that's what I was getting at. For setting up for re-election, how does he compare to, say, Obama, or who had a recession to deal with, and George W. Bush?
He's less popular than his predecessors were at this point in his presidency.
Okay. So Herb Smith was here last time. I did a podcast for The Sun. Herb Smith is retiring from his role as a political science professor at McDaniel College after 43 years. But he thought that Trump had a tough road ahead.
I do agree it's a tough road, but I don't think it's impossible at all.
Why do people think he has a shot at winning again?
Well, let's remember the fact that Hillary Clinton won in 2016. It's just this stinking electoral college system with its winner-take-all rules.
Which is still in place.
That's right. And so the smart Democrats are looking at those key states. You know, you talk in broad terms about how popular, unpopular he is. The same thing that happened in 2016 could, happen again. Another, stolen election because of our sick constitution. That's what it comes down to. So it comes down to those key states. And the smart Democratic strategists are talking economics.
Mm-hmm.
In those states, I think any of them, Biden, Bernie, any of them, are going to try to tell the Trumpies to just ask the question Reagan asked in 1980, are you better off or not, in bread and butter terms, for real. Go off the attitude and look at your bank account, all right? Look at your own real life, everyday self-interest. Can you do the sorts of things you want to do? Do you see the kind of future ahead of yourself that you've dreamed of and wanted? Here's what we can give you, for real, and see if it works.
Right. And so if you look at, again, his public approval numbers, it's not just that overlying kind of like approval, disapproval that matters. It's his approval numbers on each individual, these kind of core bread and butter issues that you're talking about. Trump does better when you ask just about his handling of the economy than he does on any other issue. When you talk about health care, it's lower than his approval, disapproval average. When you talk about education, it's lower. Immigration, it's lower.
And so the environment is much lower.
And so it's about making the case on those particular issues that it will probably be best for Democrats in those swing states. And that brings us back to the idea, and this is the Pelosi argument about impeachment. And this is the fear for them to take that step. If an election becomes a conversation about impeachment instead of a conversation about these issues, in which he does in a head-to-head with a Democrat, doesn't do as well. With handling of these sort of core issues, they want to make that election cycle about those issues rather than impeachment. And that's – and whether the virtue of impeachment or not, the electoral realities, I think push some Democrats, at least the ones who are really strategically minded about just chalking up the wins, are really concerned that it will suck all the air out of the room and refocus that conversation when it could be refocused on education,
healthcare.
Wages.
And let's talk about the economic issue again from the standpoint of emotions and psychology. It's a very interesting thing. And I would imagine that, polling data from different periods could substantiate at least some of this. But there's a very, very big difference between the kind of soundbite, sloganeering propositions offered by boomers and promoters. Look at our GNP, look at corporate profits, look at stock values, look at this, look at that. The economy is doing great. And if individual people are not doing so well, they're underemployed, they're struggling, living from paycheck to paycheck, and yet they're hearing over and over again, the economy is great. What I think goes on with the feelings of a lot of those people is, and it's probably unconscious, if the economy is doing great, why am I not getting ahead? There must be something wrong with me. And they don't want to face that. As I say, it's largely unconscious, I think. But they allow themselves, you know, to just go along with these slogans because they figure expert economists are saying so, expert commentators are saying so. If I'm not doing well, I'm the oddball, something wrong with me, and there's nothing wrong with them. They're part of a huge aggregate pattern that is not being given enough emphasis. They're part of a number pool that's not being counted right. That sort of thing. I mean, you look at the slogan soundbites from economic observers, wise men in the 1920s, and how what a great boom it was. Shot through with structural weaknesses. A lot of people, you know, finding their real-life situation getting worse and worse. That economy was setting itself up for the kind of chain reaction that started in 29. And who said it in 25, 6, 7, 8? A few people.
Okay, and then when you get to 2016, 15 and 16, it was Trump saying, I'm going to make America great again. Work on that for me, would you? Because
well,
I'm still
was,
trying to understand it.
He's a vile demagogue who is able to change the subject. That's the typical Republican strategy. Take people's minds off their real-life well-being and get them all worked up over these, you know, sick tribal persecution campaigns, you know.
like Muslims and immigrants. And,
anything will do.
Yeah.
You know,
so you think that's what his appeal was? Because I was asking you in this economic frame to
sure
explain that to me.
Sure it was. You
those people
your,
felt
your first woman
left out?
Nominee for the presidency by a major party. You've got the first African-American presidency winding down. A lot of, you know, creatures began coming out of the woodwork once Trump began to incite them. And that's exactly what he did.
So given what you said earlier about asking that question that Reagan asked, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? How are people in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio going to answer that question?
Well, I don't know, but it's an excellent question to ask because there's plenty of reason to suspect that a lot of people are not doing so well. I mean, the gap between the haves and the have-nots just keeps getting wider and wider.
I need to ask Malia this.
Sure.
This is sort of, before we move on to the Democrats, just sort of reflecting back on 2016 for one more moment here, because I have a friend who wants me to ask you this question.
Is it about polls being wrong?
No.
Okay, good, because I don't want to answer that question anymore.
This friend, actually a couple friends of mine, we were talking about this in the Swallow at the Hollow Bar.
Sure.
How do you explain people who voted for Obama in 2012, voting for Trump in 2016? And I wonder whether you had pondered that or looked at any numbers on that.
This is something that I dramatically underestimated myself in 2016, how much fervent dislike there was for Hillary Clinton. And a lot of those individuals were comfortable voting for Obama, liked Obama, maybe perhaps wanted a change, weren't maybe a little bit dissatisfied towards the end of the Obama years. You know, he was in office for 8 years. But Hillary Clinton has been a punching bag of the right since she was first lady.
Right.
And I always sort of cast it aside as perhaps a lot of maybe just like social media chatter and boy, there was a lot of vitriol for her as an individual. And just you heard this, like, I could vote for a woman, but just not that woman. And I don't know if this will come up again. If we have another female nominee, we'll get to really test that hypothesis or not. But I think the dislike of her for justified or not, frankly, I think that drove a lot of people.
Okay. If that was the case, that means a lot of engaged voters voted for Trump. These were people who would not be satisfied just sitting home.
There was a combination of factors.
There were many who did sit home.
You were asking me specifically about those who flipped.
Yeah.
And they're really not that large. That's a very, very narrow sort of subsection of the electorate in 2016. There wasn't a ton of those people who flipped.
That's an important note. Okay.
There wasn't a ton of them.
There's a lot of people who didn't vote.
There's a lot of people who didn't vote, and so there was an argument that that a lot of people thought it was in the bag for Clinton, and then didn't show up to vote. And then that also Trump activated a part of these sort of non-voters as part of that base that people frankly missed in public opinion polls. Those are individuals who didn't show up on who were not sort of consistent voters or habitual voters that they just that we dramatically underestimated that part of the electorate. Pollsters, the mistakes that we made in 2016 were basically done on one variable, that's educational attainment. We underestimated across the board, at least in those key swing states, the role that educational attainment would play. So we overestimated the amount of educated, college-educated voters in the electorate and underestimated the amount of non-college-educated voters in the electorate in most of those key swing states. That's where I think gave people a false sense of security that Clinton would win.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the blue wall, they called it. That's why the blue wall fell.
Sounds convincing to me.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
A short break from our conversation with Richard Schreiner and Malia Cromer. We'll be right back to talk about the Democrats who are lining up to challenge Trump. Hey, listeners, just a note that my new book is available through the Baltimore Sun's online store. The book is a narrative memoir called Father's Day Creek, Fly Fishing, Fatherhood, and The Last Best Place on Earth. It's not just a book about fishing, but about relationships with people and with special places in the outdoors that can serve the soul. The hardcover edition of Father's Day Creek is being offered at a pre-Father's Day discount right now. And while you're visiting the Baltimore Sun store online, check out the other titles offered there. Two great books of Sun archival photographs, books on the Orioles, the Ravens, and the Chesapeake Bay. To check out the offerings, go to store.baltimoresun.com. The Washington Post headline today, liberals go after Joe Biden, trying to blunt his presidential candidacy and the recent centrist surge in the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were among those who launched a sudden volley of attacks against Biden and his allies, showing a new urgency to wrest control of the party from moderate forces that had seized an advantage in recent months. The Post reports Sanders suggesting a Biden candidacy would send the party backwards, and Warren delivered a fierce rebuke of Biden's professed faith that Republicans will be more cooperative once President Trump is out of office. To that, she received loud cheers. So as you can see, and as you know, the dynamics of 2020 change by the day. Back to my conversation now with Malia Cromer and Richard Schreiner, recorded just before the lunch hour on Thursday. Part of the reason that people think Trump could win again is because they're not seeing a strong, promising Democratic presidential candidate yet.
You know, I hear this argument. The question. But we clearly have a front runner in the Democratic primary. Whether people want to accept it or not, Joe Biden is clearly the front runner. He's the front runner in every single national poll by double digits over his closest competitor. And he's the front runner in every key swing state primary, swing state and or primary poll that I've seen thus far among registered or likely voter Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a front runner. And when you put him in a head to head against Donald Trump right now, he bests Donald Trump in a head-to-head.
And that's all Democrats care about.
And that's
who can beat Trump.
If electability matters,
yeah,
you have a strong candidate right now.
And again, I have to emphasize emotions. Biden's strategy, and it's not just strategy, it's substance as well. It's for real. He wants to be the candidate of decency, trying to cleanse our polity of the indecency that Trump has brought with him. And the question is, can that strategy win? Because it certainly should. The emotions of the fervent, you know, tribal members of the Trump base, do any of them have any kind of conscience left at all? I'm just asking. I don't know.
Yeah.
Surely some of them are now as psychopathic as Trump himself. They're haters, and that's, you know, their fate for the rest of their lives. That's who they are. But others, I was struck in the election of 2016 by the effects upon marriages of that election, you know, the fallings out between spouses, you know, who looked at each other in some cases and for the first time saw a side of that other person, you know,
mm-hmm.
they'd been in denial about or had no reason to perceive.
Oh, this is very emotional. This goes on in families,
extremely
among
emotional.
Friends.
And
yeah.
My theory is that at least among some of the Trumpies, even the rabid ones, there may be enough conscience left. You know, you permit yourself to be a hater. long enough, if you have any kind of a conscience at all, there's a guilt process going on way down deep. Could Joe Biden, you know, tap into that wellspring and bring it to the surface? I don't know. A lot of these Trumpies, they've gotten their kick putting this deviant in the White House and chuckling over, you know, what he's able to get away with, the sort of thing they would mind getting away with, you know, anytime, right. Any day. But perhaps they've had enough of it now, and they're beginning to think in patriotic terms of what's happening to this country in regard to the things we all have in common.
I hope that isn't just wishful thinking on your part.
Well, it is wishful thinking, but it might play out. No. I don't know. I'm asking, not telling.
So Joe Biden, I think, certainly has a lane, too, that he's able to capture, maybe perhaps more so than some of the other candidates. So I went back through and I looked through all the different numbers. So why is Joe Biden doing so well? A lot of it has to do with name recognition at this stage of the race. So only 16% of individuals among Democrats can not say whether they have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of him.
They are undecided about him, you mean?
Right. So yeah. Joe Biden has a natural sort of the name recognition of years and years as a senator,
associated with Obama. Right.
And what he has that only Sanders is the only other person who has this in that race is he has extremely high name recognition. So when you're already starting to evaluate candidates, people have already made the first sort of intellectual leap. They know who he is. They can identify who he is. And the positive associations that he has as, you know, being a senator, I think, as well as just honestly 8 years of Obama being Obama's vice president, a lot of really already cues people in. And he's doing extremely well among African-American voters.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at through the southern states, particularly South Carolina, the recent poll just came out. I mean, he's crushing by double digits.
I just want to make an observation about Joe Biden. I saw him on TV the other day, a video of him stepping to a microphone to speak at a rally. And sorry, I can't remember where it was, but he looked vigorous. He actually sort of jogged to the microphone,
sure.
Didn't have a tie on, was doing sort of a Beto O'Rourke thing. And, I think he's very conscious of the fact that he's, 78 or will be 78?
Oh, that's smart. That's very smart.
Yeah, he looks good.
Donald has tried to tag him with the nickname
Sleepy Joe. Yeah.
Well, you know, just show palpably that you're nothing of the kind. You know, Trump lies again.
Right.
Judge for yourself, folks. Here I am. Very smart.
And so I'm a little bit less critical of the calling people like the Trumpies, because we're talking about a large section of the American population who voted for him, and that a lot of people where I grew up voted for him, and I don't think that these are terrible people. I don't agree with their individual vote choices on a lot of aspects, but these are American citizens that also have, I think, deep and legitimate concerns about the direction of the country. The appeal of Joe Biden or a candidate like Biden is it brings those individuals sort of back, I think, into the fold because they're moderates too. And so there's a lot of moderates and there's a lot of moderates and conservatives within the Democratic Party. And though I think he appeals to that part of the base.
Well, I'd like to meet some of those people, Malia, people who have moderate views who voted for Donald Trump.
There are. I mean, statistically, you don't have to.
Maybe
be,
my
right?
experience is more skewed because I'm a newspaper columnist and I get emails from very angry people and phone calls from mostly men who seem to be and a fair amount of women who seem to be angry about everything.
And angry emails aren't representative samples.
And hated Obama. And I hear a lot of Obama hate still.
And I understand that. And I think that you probably get a disproportionate amount of the lost voices.
Because of my job.
And the same thing. Listen, they've done studies. The same thing's happening among the progressive left on Twitter. So a really great analysis was done by the Upshot in the New York Times, where they looked at sort of Democratic voters versus Democratic voters who frequently engage on Twitter. And they're on Twitter, they're whiter and they're far more progressive in their views, where the Democratic establishment, you know, is made up with a lot of moderates and some very few conservatives, not a ton of conservatives anymore. But they're actually the majority of the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party that's represented offline is certainly less white. And
less progressive. I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, people think that there's this movement to the left. And if you're not moving to the left, you're not going to capture anyone's imagination this year. Trump will win a second term. And looking at Joe Biden and his numbers right out of the gate indicates to me that that's probably not true.
And
there are different ways to capture people's imagination. Museum. One is with an inspiring, progressive, if you will, program of real life change that lifts all boats. That's one way to inspire. But even minus a program like that, for those who feel deeply that Trump is disgracing the office, that the country has to be cleansed, he just reeks of sickness and criminality, and we must be rid of him.
Okay.
There's inspiration in getting rid of him. There's all different kinds of inspiration.
And just to clarify, too, back to Biden, and the reason he is doing so well in the polls right now and he's the clear front runner is because of the name recognition thing. And so it'll be interesting. We'll see when some of these other candidates, the Buttigiegs of the world, if Beto can actually rekindle some of that sort of spark he had from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Kirsten Gillibrand.
Kamala Harris.
I think she's one to watch, I think, especially. If these individuals, once they start to gain nationwide name recognition, if Biden right now is at his is hitting his ceiling or is he at his floor? I just want to point out one more thing, and this is just I thought this was a really interesting sort of thing from a public opinion poll. So they asked Democrats whether they thought their own party was too liberal, about right, or not liberal enough, and that's where you really can see, the Democratic primary starting to shape up. 55% of Democrats say right now the party is about right in terms of liberalism, right? It's about right. And so that's that lane. That's 55% of voters. And that will be interesting to see how people situate themselves in that lane. But a full 22% say not liberal enough. And so there certainly is in a Democratic primary where you have your sort of most enthusiastic, most progressive voters might really get behind somebody that's more from their progressive base versus a sort of Biden, Beto sort of centrist, more centrist lane. I guess you could even put Buttigieg in that lane as well.
So also this is from a swallow at the hollow conversation at the bar.
Oh, good. The best kind.
Yeah. I am a member of the bar. you need to have a woman or a minority on the ticket or the Democrats won't inspire the people they need to inspire to topple Trump.
We've had a ton of white presidents, old man white presidents, and we've over time. I think that we look at the backbone of the Democratic Party. It's African-American women. That's who's going to support you through the primaries. I think there certainly is a push to start to have a Democratic Party that actually represents the individuals that make up the Democratic Party. And frankly, if you look at the American electorate, and this is the real problem for Republicans down the line, when the Republicans start to look at themselves and they notice that they're a lot whiter than the rest of the country, particularly where the rest of the country is going, we're going to be white individuals will be in the minority within, I think it was next 40 years or something like that. It's coming.
Uh-huh.
And so unless the Republican Party starts finding ways to make inroads with voters of color.
Oh, they don't seem interested at all.
That's exactly why they're working overtime to rig the system. Pack the Supreme Court, use every trick to rig the system to, perpetuate.
Because they have no interest in that.
That's right.
Yeah.
But Democrats in turn then, if they want to be the party of diversity, then they need to not only rely on appealing to diverse voters in the electorate, they need to start electing people who look like the electorate in which they want to, continue to vote them into public office.
Right.
And there's been a lot of progress made in 2018. There were certainly, and right now we're seeing a new generation of leadership emerge. Millennials, we've had the most millennials ever elected were elected in 2018. It's the most diverse population in American history. And so these individuals now are aging up into these sort of, they can run for public office at every single level now. The oldest among us millennials are now my age at 37. Pete, we have our first sort of millennial presidential candidate. And so this new generation of leadership, I think, will spark a lot more diverse Democratic Party in terms of the not just the electorate, but the elite. So the millennials will overtake the boomers in terms of a voting bloc, the amount of registered voters. Eligible voters are the millennials. So it's their choice. But the thing what's most interesting is that there was a longtime fear that millennials would not run for public office, that millennials, by and large, saw politics as sort of a dirty business and they were interested in causes versus politics. In 2018, you saw a real fundamental shift in that. And you're seeing more, and you're seeing it here in Baltimore City as well.
Mm-hmm.
But Baltimore City, if the cards sort of, depending on how the cards fall, could end up with a majority millennial government. And it's happening across the country. And eventually, these individuals will then start to run for higher office. And these individuals look differently than the rest of the country does in terms of demographics.
Malia, Richard, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And it's time for lunch.
Okay. Wonderful.
Sounds great.
Who's buying?
I am. I'm treating you both.
Malia Cromer is an associate professor of political science and the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. She oversees the Goucher poll. Richard Striner is a professor of history at Washington College and the author of books on American presidents, film, and architecture. I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. For my producers, Steve Early and Hallie Miller, thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking and for supporting the Baltimore Sun.